Why are we trying to figure out if something's a trial? Everything, every minute of every day that you're up and awake is part of your final exam, okay? Life is the whole life is an exam. So how you handle everything, good and bad, every adversity, every good thing that flows your way. And so, of course, anytime there's more people around, like at work, that is not so much a trial, but everything is a trial. In other words, everything is about him watching to see how you handle everything. And so when if any of you have a job, you know that that's a trial. Okay? Every job is a trial. In other words, it's going to test you in being Yeshua-like moment by moment, depending on the type of job, more moments than less, but more than just you sitting at home by yourself. You're now in a place with other people, and being around other people is going to give you more opportunity to be challenged, okay? So looking at it from the right perspective is that, yes, everything, especially the job, is a testing ground. It's not a trial like it was just put there for whatever reason, but everything that you go, you're supposed to say, okay, can I be or maintain being Yeshua-like and fruit of the Spirit in this situation? And being in a hospital makes that really tough, okay? Because you got all kinds of crazy stuff happening at all times and emergencies and everything like that. And of course, there's no lack of people thinking they all know what they're doing when they don't and trying to tell you you're doing the wrong thing when you're not and whatever, okay? So, because you have more than, it's like having 15 chefs in the kitchen, okay? Everybody's got their own idea and it's all different of how to make the recipe, okay? So, yeah, you picked a challenging place to be. But don't say, is this a trial from Yah? No, you chose a career that was going to be challenging, okay? Now, there may be certain things that are happening there that are trials for you because it's a specific area that you're not working on well enough. And that area may keep coming up often enough until you focus on that and kind of fix that. Then that won't bother you as much, even though it'll probably still happen on the job. So there may be trials within your challenging experience. Does that make sense? Okay. In other words, those areas that really irritate you the most, they just keep happening over and over again. You're like, oh, you know, okay? And so, but it's not, you know, like that he's causing it as a trial, okay? Life is a trial. Have you ever noticed that? Anybody go through a day that wasn't challenging? And then you woke up and realized you were asleep during the whole thing? So that's why, okay, I mean, you know, it was just in the dream. I mean, life is challenging. You know why? Anybody have a guess of why life is so challenging? Because he's got to get you from what you are into what he is in a very short window of time. Okay, I've never said that before, so you might want to make a note of that one, okay? He gives you such a short window of time to go from what you are into what he is. So he's got to cram that full of all kinds of mess to get you to grow fast. And some of you are resisting and you're growing slow. Okay? And not embracing that which he's given you as opportunities for rapid growth. You want a lot of rapid growth? Go work at a hospital or some other place with a lot of people and it all being, that'll give you some real rapid growth if you can embrace it and really grow. Because the more people go into ministry, you want to grow, you'll grow. Okay? People, businesses, when you're around a lot of people and you're serving people, especially serving businesses, you're going to have to grow and grow a lot because you're going to be very challenged. Okay? Lead a group of people. Okay? If you're like a manager, supervisor, or whatever, you know, you go ask Billy how much fun it was managing the shoe store that he was in, when he was doing it for Payless, wherever he was, right? It was a lot of fun working for all those people. Ask Uncle Bob, the place he was working, how fun it was when people wouldn't work, wouldn't show up, wouldn't call before they wouldn't show up. Okay, when he was managing a store. You know, you get in charge and deal with people, or if you're employed and you're in a big group, it's more people, more challenges, but also more opportunity to grow. Okay, did that help?
Yes and no. Like, so what I'm hearing is, I guess maybe I chose something really challenging. And
you chose a very challenging, emotionally challenging, and physically challenging career. I mean, working in a hospital has got to be one of the roughest, you know, physically and emotionally places to be.
So in order to fix that, maybe I need to consider a different place to work. Okay.
I mean, you know, there may be ways that you could still do nursing, but do nursing in a less intense environment, you know. You could be doing it out of a smaller office and being, you know, working with a doctor there and have a lot more control over things and less voices having opinions on everything, okay? Because I'm sure at the hospital, somebody will walk in, see whatever you did, and say, who did this? Who gave them that? Why isn't this done? And or you'll walk in going, who did that? Because everybody's got their own opinion, and it's amazing how different they can be in a hospital, okay? Because I've been a patient in a hospital. I remember how one nurse might have said A, and then another one comes in and says complete opposite. Like, okay, it could be the doctor, too. One doctor says A, and another doctor comes in. I'm like, you know? I can only imagine if you're the ones doing the work and you're thinking, you know. So it's hard. People are challenging. Okay? People are definitely challenging. Okay, Ashley.
Shabbat shalom, Rabbi.
I was going to say, speaking of challenging people, but I didn't think that.
I was thinking it, so it would have been all right. But you remember you
Billy was
me.
Thinking that so loud, so I said it. I could see him just over there thinking it. So.
But on that note, I'm thankful that you still take me after challenge after challenge after challenge to help me go to there. So thank you.
You're not any more challenging than anybody else.
No, I know, but it's fun to think that sometimes.
You're like being my problem child, right? Okay. Go ahead.
I'm still thinking about what we talked about at Sukkot about the bridegroom. I've been really stuck on that. And when Annabelle was talking about that, she really, I don't know what she did, but she just stirred something up in me. And I was talking to my husband earlier this week, and in order to have a marriage, there has to be an engagement, correct?
Usually there's a betrothal, yes.
Okay. And for the woman, because obviously I'm not a man, so I don't know what goes through a man's head. And I don't want to know what goes through a man's head, but...
That's good thinking right there.
But my...
Definitely don't want to know what's going on through a man's
No. But when a man asks a woman to marry him, he usually knows the answer. Otherwise, he wouldn't put all the effort into it, correct?
Usually.
Okay. I'm going somewhere with this. The reason why I'm asking that is because when... we go get to the married to Yahweh. Us, men and women, when we want to go there, we're asking him, will you marry us? And when we ask...
We're the bride. He's asking us to marry him.
Okay, but how would I want to word this then? The reason why I was saying it like that is because don't we know through our actions and through our walk, or shouldn't we know where we're headed and like if we're going to make it or not?
Well, yes, and there's no, and I've said that many times, okay? Because people have said often enough that the way I teach gives them no hope and this and that because there's no foundational, solid rock of once saved, always saved, and all this other nonsense out there that people believe. So therefore, they actually have to continuously focus and do their things that they need to do all the way till the end. And so, but I've always said though. So yes, you won't know that you've actually made it till he says, well done, good and trustworthy servant. But in the meantime, you should have every confidence that you will if you're doing the things that cause the words, well done, good and trustworthy servant. If you do things with the effort, the best you can, with the proper owning it, fixing it, and adjusting, you know, that whole repentance thing and everything else, if you're doing what needs to be done to maintain and develop that vertical relationship correctly, you should have every confidence that you're going to make it. Okay? But you also need to be honest with yourself and know if you're fooling yourself or not. And if you figure that out, hopefully, before you die, then you can fix it. If you know you've been fooling yourself. Okay? The example I always gave was I knew people that would, you know, get all nervous in school before taking an exam. And I was like, why are you all nervous about it? I said, well, I'm going to fail. I said, did you study? No. Well, what do you think you're going to get? I don't know, 65. Fine. What do they end up getting? 65. So why were you all nervous? You knew what you were going to get. You knew the effort you put in. You knew that you how well you knew the subject. I don't think I ever got a grade that surprised me. Okay? That's not true. One time, I knew nothing on the test. I literally just guessed. I made a pretty pattern on the form, you know, A, C, C, D, C, B, C, A, C, D, C. And I made it look all pretty, and I ended up getting an 85. I don't know how that happened, but the odds of that are, like, incredible. But I just made a pretty pattern. I didn't even read the questions. Okay, but otherwise, I was never surprised. It was on a computer programming class that I never took. I never went to class, so I didn't know anything. So I went and take the exam. And I ended up passing. You know, I got a passing grade. So, but almost always I knew exactly within a few points what I was going to get, because I knew how much I already knew the subject and how well I studied or whatever, how prepared I was, whatever. So you should not be surprised in the exam of life. You should know exactly how hard you've been working and studying and preparing and performing and doing the things that need to be done. So you should not be surprised. If you're doing things the way you need to be doing them, which includes when you mess up, you fix it, then you should have every confidence that you're going to hear the words you want to hear. Okay?
And that was going to be my follow-up question. When I do mess up, and I do try to own it, fix it, and move on deal, the fact that I can move on, that's my knowing of, okay, this ain't over yet?
Right.
Okay, perfect. Thank you.
Look, I want to just emphasize that last point you made. Every one of you, okay, comes from a place where you were not walking this, right? There was a time before you did this. And so what did you do when you started doing this? You repented and stopped doing a bunch of things you used to do. And then you moved on. So why don't you do that again, like today when you have a mistake, or tomorrow? I mean, anytime you realize you're doing something wrong, like when you first came into this, you realize, oh, wow, I'm not eating right. I'm keeping the wrong days. I'm celebrating the wrong things. What did you do? You made changes, right? So anytime you do something that you realize was not correct, you do the same thing. You make the change. Making the change is what he wants. He doesn't want you to kill yourself and beat yourself up and be all miserable. He wants you to own it, recognize it, and fix it. And you can do that with more or less emotion. I mean, I don't think the emotional level has anything to do with it. Okay, he's not looking to get a pound of flesh out of you for making a mistake. He wants you to figure it out, fix it, and move on. Okay, by fix it meaning so that's no longer a problem. So, but some of you, you can't let it go because you're so ashamed and so embarrassed and so this and so that. So all you do is beat yourself up and beat yourself up. Why? The only thing you should be upset about is if you're not actually fixing it. Okay, if you're kind of covering it up in some way and putting a Band-Aid over it, or, you know, but you're not actually fixing it. But if you actually fixed it, in other words, you actually repented of it, made a commitment, you're not going to do it again, et cetera, then you should have a good, strong, positive disposition to move forward in your walk. He doesn't want you to now to walk around with your head hanging low for another 6 months just because you want to feel guilty and terrible because you slipped up. Okay? Okay? Good. All right, Shama Steve.
Okay. I saw written here something, and I just want to see if my thinking is right here. Character versus personality. So if character is the mental and moral qualities of an individual, and then the personality is a combination of the characteristics that form the individual, so if personality comes out of characteristics, isn't it an advantage to work on our strengths in addition to the weaknesses? That way we can achieve growth rather than ending up in counseling forever?
Yes. Yes. Okay. Let me repackage that a little bit. So like, for example, for all of you that did the color code test, you know, we talk about the personality test that we all took as part of our fun during one of the feasts. Okay. So one of the things you were supposed to get out of that is to kind of have a sense of why you are the way you are because of your personality, right? You tend towards certain things because of that. It's kind of a large part of this is just born into you, okay? You tend to be, you know, more or less outgoing, more or less interested in fun or peace or this or leadership or that or whatever it is, right? You have these things that you found out about. But then the next step in it, though, was to figure out which of your personality styles were dominant and to work on continuing to develop the positive aspects of that, as well as adding in the positive aspects maybe of your personality that really weren't there that much. Like, for example, I've talked about often enough how I lacked two of the colors. But I make an effort to add positive white and blue color personality traits because I don't have any white or blue, period. Okay? But now some of you have a bunch of a color, but more of the negative traits than the positive traits. You just happen to have a lot of that color. Well, you know what? Work on diminishing the negative sides of that color and working on developing and strengthening the positive ones. Okay? So just because you've got a lot of something doesn't mean that you've got all the positive traits, and it doesn't mean that you're proficient in them and using them and taking full advantage of the benefit of those positive traits. And so you can and should work on those. So definitely work on building the strengths up even more and working on minimizing the negative aspects. All right, Mr. Craig.
So I guess a couple comments. Last night you were talking about attraction, and then just a little while ago talking about its attachments to things. And my wife and I got married young, and if we were set on things, very little of the things I were when we got married, I still am now. And there's times when if we're so attached to the things about that person that when those things either go away by age or an accident, say with our experiences and disabilities, that when my ability to take care of my family isn't there, that love still needs to be there. Now, I need to love my spouse in a way that's deeper than her things. It's hard to explain, but the attachment to things can go into what people can give to us that we love, and we don't actually love them for just who they are and what they are. More than
okay, I think I know what you're trying to get to. So let me kind of kind of position it this way. You have absolutely, and this is something everybody should be listening to. If you're going to get married and be married over a number of years, enough number of years, the person is probably going to change in some areas at some point. Okay, especially if you start off really young, like Craig did. Okay, and so yeah, you have to know that you're not necessarily going to be married to the same person 20 years later in all aspects as you were when you first got married. That can happen. It could be bad. It could be good. I mean, it can go in either direction, or it can be a sort of a mixed bag of a little good, a little bad. But not be attached to that. But also, I want you to understand that when you're looking at your spouse, you should always be looking at it from your relationship from the point of view of, can't or won't. Okay? If your spouse can't do something, then you should have a lot of compassion and understanding for something they can't do, like in case they end up in a handicapped position, like Craig was mentioning. Because that's not a won't, it's a can't. All right. If somebody just won't, and they should, you would be very frustrated, and that could affect your love and attraction to them. Okay, so you must be able to identify. I tell the story all the time. I had a couple that I counseled. The lady was part of the ministry at large, and the husband wasn't, and they were already separated. They'd already split and were living in different houses, and he agreed to call me, and he called me up, and we were talking, and come to find out and talking to her also that she had this problem with the way he expressed his love for her. And when I talked to him, I found out from him it's something he just can't do. It's not something that he knows how to do. It's not a won't. He just doesn't have the skill set to express in a natural way. He's handicapped in that area. And so I talked to her, and she's like, well, I don't know why he can't do this and why he can't do that for me. I said, wait a minute. What if it actually is a can't, though? Use the word can't. She goes, what do you mean? I said, well, what if he can't do it? She's like, oh. I said, because I talked to him, and he really wants to do all this stuff. He just can't do it. He really struggles. And it changed everything, and they got back together. Because she was no longer having this expectation that he was just not doing something that because he wouldn't. You need to figure out if some of the problems you're having with your spouse are can'ts and not won'ts. It's something they actually struggle with, either psycho-emotionally or physically. Because if you are focusing on it being something that's an excuse instead of a reality, or a deficiency instead of a reality, now, the can't can be worked with. Maybe it's something they can develop to make it a can. Maybe you find workarounds to make it a kind of, sort of. Maybe it's not a full can. Okay, like they can't really do it in the fullest way that a person without a handicap, but maybe there's a workaround so they can get it somewhat done, whatever that is that you need. Okay, and so you learn to do that, but you have to, and Craig's point is good, don't let your attraction level be based on not also adjusting to the fact that there could be a can't in there, something that has changed them where they no longer can do something the way they used to do it. And that could be an injury. It could be something, a trauma. It could be anything. All right? So it's a good point.
That could be the same with ministry or church as well, to think that the Father couldn't take any of us men and do away with all the things that we struggle with to make us a perfect husband, so our wives would have no problem in submission, be the same thing that he could do within the leadership of a structure. Like maybe there's a lot to being submissive to somebody that we know that they could have some can'ts too, like not just won'ts or, and sometimes within ministry it's even more complex, all kinds of things. But I think that there's some of that too, where we're to be submissive to, it's got to be his will, or he could not have us struggle in such ways.
Okay, hold on. So what I want to expand on that is that, and an elder has pointed this out, and I think it's something that Craig is pointing out that I can kind of expand on, which is some of the people you're dealing with, leadership, spouses, may be expressing some of the things you want, but just not in the form or in the... See, elder will tell you that I'm one of the most patient people he's ever met. And some of you are thinking, he's crazy. Because you've seen me in areas where I'm not very patient. Because I'm not in some areas. So your spouse may be whatever it is you're missing in one area, may be a lot of that in a different way, but you're just not embracing that also because it's not where you wanted it to be. Does that make sense? Because I have some people that think I'm incredibly merciful and compassionate and all this other stuff, and other people think I'm the opposite because of their personal experience in the limited way that they've experienced it. So if you're married, you may want your spouse to be a certain whatever in a certain types of situations, and they're not, but they are in another one, but you're not giving them credit for that. You're not seeing that there is a capacity for it in certain ways. All right?
I add something to that real quick. I happened to see a story. It was a violinist, and he happens to be like the top violinist. The last concert he did, he played a piece of music that was worth like $3.3 million. It's like the most complex piece. He stood in the subway of a city and played that exact same piece and got $3 in tips. So it can be a lot of, I think what you were saying, a lot of the things we see can be great, has a lot to do with those that are around us too. So it's, yeah. It was just kind of one of those things. And then my last kind of question is, I've heard you talk a lot about the problem of reaping, and that you're not necessarily going to reap harvest exactly where you sow. A lot of the problems, maybe Western problems, is that we reap right into an area where we expect to sow, and that we could be blind to the harvest that we're not seeing behind us, or off to the side,
right,
or something like that. So in modern kind of times and business-wise, how do we focus on a skill set that makes money when not getting distracted by a lot of the stuff out there? It's just, if it's an easy button money make, it's not likely to make any money. How do we really discern an opportunity that comes along business-wise or personally that might be that harvest that we didn't actually prepare for? Or are we always going to be prepared for a harvest that we can expect?
All right. You know what I mean? That was a little bit of a complex question, I guess, because it had a couple elements too. But the main, okay, at some point, you should probably figure out a way to afford and come to the class that I do, because I'm going to cover all that. But as far as picking businesses and understanding, but I'll give you a little bit of that here. Number one, please have heard Craig's point that if it looks too good to be true, it probably is. And of those simple button pushing, you'll be a millionaire next week things, doesn't work, okay? What you want is you want to find, first of all, lucrative, steady employment. Put money aside to start your little side hustle deal, whatever that's going to be, and let that take time to develop. And then what side hustles are you going to do? Something that you can learn from somebody that actually you see them doing it, not just selling a course. Okay, so mostly their side hustle is to sell you the course. Okay, and they're making most of their money selling you a course. So you'd like to actually see them doing the actual thing and watch it done, see them actually reaping the profits and all that kind of stuff, which is not always easy to do with these sort of scammy courses that are out there, okay? And so this is the kind of thing that, like, for example, I decided recently that I wanted to do a little bit more. Back in the day, I used to trade commodities, and so I like to trade Forex a little bit, which is currency market. And I found a really good course for that that I started watching about a week or two ago. I watched it a lot on the boat, actually, when I was just chilling. But the guy who made this course, he's showing exactly what he does. He's showing the live trades that he's doing. And I know enough about this to know that he knows what he's talking about, because he's using a lot of information I used when I did commodities. But I like that he's covering all the different things, and I'm watching the live. He shows, this is what I'm doing. This is the trade. Now, this is why I did it, and this is the strategy. Now, let's see what happens with it. And so I'm getting to actually be mentored by someone who's actually doing, okay? Not just selling me an idea of how I could be doing. I want to see what they're doing. I want to see that they did it and it worked and those kind of things. And so the main thing for all of you, though, is you must start with a dependable foundational income base. Okay, that's called a job. Okay, I don't like jobs. I don't think anybody should like a job. But a job serves a purpose till you can go and do something else. Okay? All right? Now, some of you, jobs are great, period, because it's great to have the steady income, it's dependable, and you get paid well enough, and that's all great. But I'm saying for those of you that don't like the idea of the employer and that control thing or whatever else, fine, suck it up, deal with it, get through it, put money away, and then use that money to now start something. Whatever online business you want to do, whatever brick and mortar type of thing you want to do, whatever consulting thing you want to do, whatever it is, use that money to educate yourself. And then to practice and blow it a few times. And you're going to make mistakes, okay? And you're going to start things that don't work. I've started a lot of businesses, and a lot of them did not work, okay? Some of them worked really well. Some of them did not. You got to be okay with that, all right? Okay? You know, there's a guy who won a contest where everybody started with $10,000 to see how much and turn it into $1 million and sold long in the stock market or whatever it was that we're doing in it. It was in the futures, market, in the commodities. And he ended up turning $10,000 into $1 million. What people don't know is he actually turned it into $2 million and lost half of it the last day or last week. Okay? Okay, so, I mean, you know, just so you know. You'd be like, wow, he turned 10,000 into a million. No, he actually turned it into 2 million and then lost half of it. It can be quick. All right, it can go very quickly. So just keep that in mind. But that's a good question, Craig. But that's why what I would recommend to all of you is at some point you want to take some courses in understanding how to start, run business. It's like general stuff, how to be able to monitor the financial aspects, the legal aspects, setting up your corporation, if you're going to have a corporation or LLC or whatever you're going to do, understanding the tax ramifications and how that all works. I mean, you really need to learn these things. Look, I've done so many things that I have a lot to when people come and talk to Elder and I, a lot of times they ask us about some of these business things. I said, well, we have a lot of advice we can give because we've both done a lot of things business-wise. Okay, we've started things, we've run things, we've had authority in businesses, we've managed businesses, and all those kind of things. And that's experience that you can't just get in a book. You have to have someone who has that experience deliver it to you, answer questions, mentor you in some way, all right? But the point is, don't rush to go do this without the core, okay? The core is, can you pay your bills? You need something that pays your bills, hopefully plus a little bit towards your other thing, all right? And do not, some of you thinking, you're talking way too much about this stuff on Shabbat. No, this is important. Do not quit your job till what you're doing makes more than what you are already doing. In other words, your side thing has to out, and not just for 1 week. I mean, for like 6 months. And think about it, you'll be getting two incomes for 6 months because you got one, both making about the same. But I want you to, don't say, oh, wow, I just hit a number that's bigger than, no, then you quit and your thing goes down the toilet. You want to see consistency. I want you to have at least 6 months success before you switch over. All right? All right, Chris.
Okay, so my question is, it's not like eschatology or anything like that per se, because I want to know, because you say that people are not judged, of course, and the covenant you can't have judgment without people being in covenant, or it's not called sin. So when Yeshua comes back and the world is judged, how is it possible that all these people that we know don't understand what we understand about Yeshua, Torah, how are they able to be judged for if they don't have that, the bubble popped, I guess, in Revelation?
All right. So the question is, what are they being judged? In other words, what are the choices in the judgment? Okay, we read about one choice being eternal life or eternal punishment, the punishment being forever. Like, you don't get to come back. Is that the judgment we're talking about for the whole world? Yeshua comes back. Some of us are going to be resurrected or changed right there. Not resurrected, changed in a twinkling. That's part of a judgment. He's going to make a judgment that you're ready. Yes? Some are going to be judged in the graves and brought out of the graves as being ready for that first resurrection. Some are going to be judged to need to go through the millennium. Some who died are going to be judged to be resurrected and go in the flesh in the millennium. So it's a matter of what they're being judged for. Okay? So everybody's going to be judged according to the same standard. The standard being, did I bubble pop you? Then the choice is going to be the fire or the change in a twinkling. If you weren't bubble popped, then the judgment is that you're now going to get your chance to have your bubble popped. Okay? And then you're going to get to walk that out.
It's not so much that they're being judged at that time for something they've been doing, but rather it's more like the whole world being destroyed and everything is more to set up the millennium.
No, yes and no. They're being judged in the context of what they were given. Okay, if they weren't given anything, then the judgment is to give them that first opportunity with their bubble popped. Listen to Millennium and Kingdom teaching for those who haven't listened. If you had had your bubble popped, then there's an expectation, a context to the judgment as to whether or not you've made the choice to be submissive to that covenanting. And if you've rejected it, then you probably have an appointment with the fire. Okay? And so it's really, the context has to do with what he's judging is basically like the parable of the talents. He's saying, what did you do with what I gave you? For most of the world, nothing. He hasn't given them anything yet. So he's not going to judge them against anything. They're just acting like he expected them to act without any relationship with him. Okay? For those who he gave, he's going to see what you did with it. And based on what you did with it, then he's going to judge you in that fashion. And so it's really going to be based on what he, to be fair, right? He says he's a righteous judge. He judges with fairness. So it's going to be based on what did he give. Otherwise, it'd be completely a respecter of persons thing and unfair that he chose you and nobody else. Or you and not other people in your family. You and whatever, right? Why did he pick you? Were you so special? Absolutely not, right? We all know that there's nothing super special about us individually. Why he picked us? He just did. But he didn't pick us because he's not going to pick them. He picked us because this is the time when he wanted us to do it. And so to be fair in that judgment, they will be judged according to their works. And he's going to say, you guys acted just like I expected you to, like the world. And so I'm now going to put you in a new world with new leadership, with Yeshua on the throne. Open up your mind and now let's see what you do. And I'm going to give you a whole bunch of immortal beings that are going to be there to help you and guide you. Over 5 cities, over 10 cities, whatever you're going to be given, as we deal with the billions of people still around on the planet. Okay?
1,000 years seems pretty short for that.
Well, no. Can you consider how much you were going to figure this out in less than 100? Okay? Because most of us got called over age 20 or 30 or 40, so we didn't need that many years to figure it out. So 1,000 years is more than enough time. And especially then if he brings people in waves of like every, like once a generation of 50 or 70 years, brings in another wave of people to work with as each one makes their choices. So 1,000 years is plenty of time.
Okay, could I ask one more question?
Sure.
Okay, and this is about Job chapter 38 in verse 2. So this is when Yahweh answers Job, because the rest of what Job is about, the people talking to each other. But as far as what Yahweh says, after Elihu, It says, then Yahweh answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge? And then it's a lot longer than that. But I saw one person online saying he was actually talking to Elihu, who was the person he's talking about, who darkens counsel by words without knowledge, because we think of Job as a very righteous person. And I wanted to just ask about that verse and then kind of the rest of Job with, as I read Job from time to time and try to understand deeper what the issue is at the end of Job, because I know at the start we have Job as patient and through the trial. So what that verse was about, if Job is the one darkening counsel without knowledge, I guess would be the main question.
That's an interesting question, especially because if you look at chapter 42, which is the end of the book, verse 3 says exactly the same thing. Okay? It says, who is this that hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore I declared, but I did not understand. Matters too marvelous for me, which I did not know. Okay, it says, Job answers Yahweh here. He says, you know that you are able to do all, and that no purpose is withheld from you. That's a very important verse to remember, is Job 42:2. Okay? Nothing is outside of his ability. You're able to do all things. Okay? So then he goes, who is this that hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore I declared, but I did not understand. So he's talking about himself there after he was talking in chapter 38. So it kind of ties together.
I think he's owning it there, kind of?
I think he's owning it there. Yeah. Okay? Because then he starts talking about matters too marvelous for me to even think about. Okay, he's like, I'm like trying to maybe dwell on my own counsel, and it's like stuff that's way above my even thinking about it.
So he was righteous before this time, but I guess he's realizing the main point for us, I guess, is to not try to just talk a lot in suffering when we're like, I guess, trying to justify ourselves is the
point. All right,
point.
So understand, when we call Job righteous, okay, we look at Job as a tzaddik, someone without the yetzirah, this without the evil inclination. This simply means that he was not tending towards or drawn towards doing something that was against Yahweh. That didn't mean he understood everything that Yahweh was doing. He didn't understand the purposes of everything. He didn't have all knowledge and wisdom. He just made right choices and wasn't tempted to make wrong ones. And now he's saying here at the end, he says, and there's so many things I never understood. I knew what to do and how to do it and what was right to do. So he was righteous, but he didn't have all wisdom and understanding. Okay, did that help? Okay, good. All right, Janet?
Rabbi, can I ask you a follow-up question from what you just said before?
Sure.
So when you were talking about the parable of the talents, and you were saying he wants to know what you do with what he's giving you.
Right.
So understanding that obviously everything that happens to us is because he's allowing it at least, and what you were saying to Tamara earlier. So it's not just the talents. I always thought talents is more like resources, but it's really everything, right? Talents will include your personality, skills, your experiences, learning.
It's a metaphor picture for being given something and what you do with it. Okay? So, for example, you're given a husband. What'd you do with it? You're given children. What'd you do with it? You're given Beth Shalom here in Cleveland. What'd you do with that? I mean, you come here. You have leadership. What'd you do with that? Did you do anything with that? Okay? In other words, he gives you things, makes them available, and then wants to see what are you going to do with it. Okay? What are you doing with it? We've got a lot of people here that are doing nothing with what's available to them. Okay? Or a very limited amount of what's available to them. They don't come for counsel. They don't do the things that are necessary there. You're given all these opportunities. So when the parable says, I gave you this thing of value, okay, a husband, child, a wife, whatever side you're on, right? Okay, leadership, a congregation members. I mean, I've given you all of this, and what did you do with it? Okay? Did you take the most advantage you can of the opportunity that he's given you, that what he's offered to you? Or did you just take it for granted or just show up because, hey, it's a service to go to and to go home and to not be a part and not participate and, you know? What are you doing with the things he's given you that are of value? Okay, so it's value. The talent is talking about something of value. So what are you doing with the thing that's been given to you that has that value? And he wants to see if you're going to do something to develop the value, take advantage of the value, grow the value. Okay? Does that make sense? All right, good. All right, Gary.
Shabbat shalom, my rabbi.
Shabbat shalom.
I have a question about head cover.
Okay.
When I'm standing here and we're praying, I don't know if it's the 60-some years of Catholicism beat into me. I feel like I should be taking my hat off when I when we're praying. Where do we stand with head cover?
Okay. Well, whether you're sitting or standing, I mean, you know. look, it's tradition. Because you were in a Jewish community, they wouldn't do anything without their head covered. Okay, and so it's neither here nor there. Wear it or don't wear it. It's what's coming out of your mouth and what's going on in your heart that matters. Okay. Now, of course, it depends on what you're wearing on your head. Okay. Wearing an MTOI hat or something that's respectfully being worn is one thing. Wearing something that's promoting your sports team or some other thing may not be what you need to be wearing in the place of worship and that kind of deal. Okay. So it's really about, you know, what are you covering your head with? Okay. So if you got something that, you know, has some little saying on it or something that's properly, vertically, you know, focused, because people have all kinds of hats with all kinds of good things that way. It may just say Shabbat Shalom on it, may say this on it, whatever it is. That's one thing. So, but if you feel like you should take it off, then take it off. Because it's really about, you want to feel congruently right inside. And it could be your upbringing, because I know that there's an upbringing that has people, you know, taking off their hats when they go in certain places. They have, you know, there used to be a tradition that when people were walk in a room, that other people would stand up. Okay, and I want to thank the few of you that actually still do that for me. It surprises me when it happens, but there's times when I walk in to go counsel with somebody and they'll stand up when I walk in the room. That's a very respectful thing to do. It's not required. It's a tradition. But certainly it conveys a level of respect. Okay? All right? And so, but that's cultural connected. It's culturally connected and it's traditionally connected. So you're welcome to keep your hat on, okay? But if you feel that you should take it off, then take it off. Either way. All right? You're welcome, Gary. All right. Mercy.
Hey, Rabbi. Thank you. If we can go back to health for a second.
It's a round trip. It's okay.
Yes. Okay. Yes, yes, yes.
we're taking a round trip visit.
Yeah,
back.
Yeah. It's a cruise.
Can I tell you something? It is amazing how you can be on a boat with 4,300 people and still run into each other everywhere you go. Like the three people you know on the boat. It was just like, you know. Mercy came to breakfast, went to sit down, and she heard a voice turn around. And it was me and Uncle Bob sitting right behind her. She's like, oh, look. Everywhere I looked, there was Mercy. There was Marlene was there. Everything. I walked around somewhere. I mean, 4,300 people. If we wanted to, we couldn't have found each other to run into each other. But we did all the time. So it was hysterical. All right, go ahead.
So just to kind of, I guess, be clear and kind of get your updated counsel on this. Now, I believe everything that you're saying about it, so I just want to start by that. That's my disclaimer. However, the church that I sort of kind of grew up in, the one that my mom and her family grew up in, they were apostolic, which is pretty much Pentecostal, and, you know, then they went into non-denominational. So when it comes to hell, one of the things that I had always heard was hell was not a place that the Father sent you. It was a place that you sent yourself. That was because he doesn't want anybody to go there. He doesn't want anybody to suffer. He doesn't want anybody to be tortured. But you're putting yourself there because you just are not being obedient to what he's saying. And in that regard, you didn't accept JC as your Lord and Savior. And it was enlarging daily because of the fact that people just refused to do that, but it was their own, it was their own selves that were putting them there. And he was not trying to do that, da 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 da. So I don't know if that was if it was a way to kind of explain it. Do you understand what I'm saying?
No, I understand. You're basically saying that it's not believing in a God that would do this to you. But that's not the way it's worded. It's worded that your reward or what you reap from sowing, and Paul talks about this in Romans 2, is either eternal life or this condemnation and wrath. Okay, so yes, you are going to do what brings the reward of eternal life too. But he's going to give that to you. Okay? You're going to earn the punishment, and he's going to give that to you. Okay, so either way, that's going to play out. But let me ask you this, for all of you, okay? Are you not already living in hell? In other words, this life is, for a lot of you, torture, suffering, misery. Can you not see the mercy? Because some of you, you know, well, I can see the mercy right there. Okay, so, but some of you, okay, some of you have considered suicide because you figure that that would be the oblivion away from all the suffering and the pain. And so Abba's saying, I'm willing to put you out of all that misery at the end of all this. Not that you should quit in that direction, but that I will, because that would be the merciful thing to do. You're already in hell, suffering, miserable. Look, before you knew the truth, all the things that you did in life, was it working well? Was it bringing good fruit? Were you just wonderfully peaceful and happy? Okay, no, because you are living in hell. Hell is doing it your way. Okay, making all your own choices so that you know what's right and wrong and all these other things. And it just leads to pain and suffering, which is what we picture hell to be the metaphor for. And so in his love and compassion, once the journey is finished, okay, for those people, he's going to just put them out of their misery, okay, so to speak. And that's mercy, and that's compassion, that's love. Now, he's given them a way to have the good stuff, but they're not choosing it. They're choosing to stay in the misery, okay? So him and his mercy, rather than see them suffer forever, is going to put that to an end. He gave them the path out of it, and they chose not to take the path. So let's be clear that everybody's going to be shown the path into the light, so to speak, right? A path out of the darkness and misery into the light and the joy. But there are those that were going to choose the darkness. And it talks about that in Scripture. He says they were given the light, yet they chose and loved darkness. And so those people also cause other people suffering and pain. So he's going to take that out of the mix at the same time. They're not going to cause anybody else any more suffering, nor themselves. And then he doesn't have to watch his children miserable and suffering. Does that make more sense? Okay.
So then, since I am mercy, am I here to put people out of their misery? Because I'd gladly take that on.
Yeah, but it may be not doable with a knockout punch. Or shot to the throat or something.
Right. Okay. Shot to the heart, yeah. But you're to blame. So
Don't be giving love a bad name. Okay.
Sorry. Okay, so my next question is, in 1 Samuel, do you remember when it talks about how the Philistines were fighting with the Israelites and they ended up stealing or taking or capturing the Ark of the Covenant? So when they take it and they start getting, you know, the father's putting all these things on them, da 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 da, and they're like, oh my God, you know, this is like the true El and he's doing this to us, blah, 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 let's give this thing back. And each town it went to, somebody, they were getting the same thing, the boils and, you know, all that stuff. Why do you think it's possible that that could happen? They can recognize it. They can say, okay, we're going to take these two. It was like they knew to take two calves or two cows that had, or bulls that had never, you know, had no blemish or anything. They actually said that. And then let them lead the Ark of the Covenant to where it's supposed to be. Now, if they go this way, that means it was chance and circumstance. If they go this way, then that means that this was Yah, and, you know, we're going to put all these things in here to kind of offer to him. Why would they do all that, knowing and recognizing that this is who he is and that he's real? And they recognize that, but yet and still they still decided that they were going to worship their false gods, because this is actually the time when he had their god fall to the ground, the statue fall to the ground, worship him, cut their hands off and everything like that. Why would they not recognize that when you can see it, not when you can't see it? I mean, he was doing some crazy things back then, and you could see it, you can touch it, you can feel it. Why? Go.
Okay. Go.
Go.
You're on. Okay. Look, look, this is hard to understand now, easier to understand if you lived back then. Because you're saying things, and you actually used, at the end, you actually nailed it by saying there were some crazy things happening. But you know what? Crazy things happened all the time in the names of all kinds of gods back then, okay? And so this was just another one of them to them. This wasn't like something that made it clear this was the one true. It just meant this one had power, like some of the other ones that seemed to have power that they had been experiencing in their own lives culturally back then. Okay, so, because remember, even in Pharaoh's day, the magicians did the same things that Yahweh did. They didn't say that they used smoke and mirrors. They did similar things. And so there was a lot of supernatural things happening from the false deity world. And so when they recognized they had something that was not appropriate for them to have from a god, not necessarily the god, but from a god, they wanted to now rid themselves of that and appease that god. They may have done that had they taken, if the worshippers of Chemosh took something from Dagon and something was going wrong, they would have wanted to give it back to Dagon. So they were not necessarily connecting that this is the god. They were connecting that this particular god was not pleased. So let's appease this god and get rid of this thing, okay? But culturally, we don't understand that the same, because we don't see so much of that manifesting of power that they would have seen then in the names of these pagan entities, okay? Okay, good. All right, Brandy.
Sorry, follow-up question to your good steward. Okay, so I know I counsel with you. When we first met, you talked about money as tools, favorite counseling session ever. It helped me. When we celebrate a feast, it's no hold anything. You say he wants you to experience, just go for it, right? When you talk about being a good steward, let's say you are not borrowing from Peter to pay Paul. You have your tithes, you have your offerings, you pay your bills. You are not, there's not more month at the end of your check, end of your money, right, or something like that. And I know Bill Gates only drives a Honda Civic. Oh, my gosh, I hear that all the time. But if you have the means and you're like, everyone has a thing. I'm sure Bill Gates has fancy shoes. But if you have the thing and it's like, okay, you know what? I don't want to drive a Honda Civic. I can afford a Tesla. I'm going to drive a Tesla. And it does not cause a shift in your finances. Is that something like that would be okay? Like, what's the Absolutely. Standard so you're not a cheapo?
No. Look. You have to look at things financially from a relativism point of view, okay? If I've got, you know, $500 to my name, okay, in the bank, and that's all I've got, and I barely make it through each month and pay my bills, then if I go out and I spend $50 on a steak, that's 10% of what I've got left, okay? Because you can go to, like, you know, one of those nice steakhouses, easily spend $50 on a steak. However, if you've got $50,000 in the bank and your finances are in perfectly good shape, then you may want to go and have a nice dinner with your spouse or whatever, and it may spend $100 on that dinner, because that $100 is a very small piece of a $50,000 or $100,000 you have in the bank compared to $500 you got in the bank. So it really has to do with from a relative piece of work in terms of terms. So if you're making, you know, $40,000 a year, $30,000 a year, right? So you're making $15 an hour, you make $30,000 a year, whatever, then you're probably not going to own a 5,000 square foot house that runs $500,000, okay? But if you make $150,000 or whatever, you make some other kind of money, then you might be able to live in a bigger house and be able to have more space to do the thing. I'm not talking about a crazy mansion with 37, you know, bedrooms and stuff, but I'm saying you may be able to live in a bigger space more comfortably with a little bit of land on it. It's really relative to the context of where you are financially.
So it's quantifiable. Like it's not... good steward usually is spoken in sense of an idea.
So good steward is that you're not spending money that's going to put you in any kind of adverse financial place. So if you can afford... Look, when I was, say, 18, 20 years old, I went to go find a car that would be in decent enough shape, just like my kids today. We'll be looking for a used car that's relatively reliable, in decent shape, under $10,000. Or under something, you know, where a new car is going to run them $30,000, $40,000. Whatever new cars run these days is crazy. Okay? But then you get older and you start thinking, well, I can get a nicer vehicle. And it's, my financial state is similar, but now that car price affects me the same as the cheaper one did when I was making less. And so you can make different choices, all right? Look, I remember when, for example, I just went on this cruise, okay? And they offer an internet package, and I wanted the internet package because I wanted to do certain things that I need the internet for. Well, it's $20-something dollars a day. There was many, 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 many years in my life where that would have been a crazy and stupid way to spend money. Because percentage of where I had any money was I didn't have any. Okay? But I'm at a place now where I say, you know what? I worked hard and I could enjoy myself and I could spend the $20 to have that enjoyment. And it doesn't adversely affect my finances because I've done what I need to steward-wise over the last however many years, you know? Okay, so it's really a matter of the kind of the context of where you are financially. So, you know, don't be surprised one day when I do actually go out there and buy my Cobra, all right? Which Billy really wants me to buy. Okay? All right, when I get away from the minivan and get to the Cobra. And the thing is, it's relative to where you are. Now, half the people watching went, well, I'm not sending any tithe money and he's going to buy a Cobra. All right, your tithe money doesn't go to me like that, okay? I get paid a salary, all right? So it doesn't matter how much money comes in. I get paid the same either way. All right, so, but the thing is, I've worked, I'm almost 60 years old. I've worked 45 years or whatever since I was 15 years old, getting jobs. And over time, you create yourself a certain level of financial stability and wealth. And then at those points, you can now make choices to do things that would not have been wise or made sense at a different place. Okay? I've been broke. I've been bankrupt. I know what it's like to have nothing or less than nothing, negative. All right? And what choices there are very much more limited when you go to make things. But when you're in a different place and you've earned it, you've worked for it, you've gotten yourself there. I remember having an argument in my head, okay? The first time I went to decide to pay the $70 at that time for the football subscription thing. So you could watch the games anytime, right? Because I work a lot on Sundays with leadership meetings and counseling, so I don't get to watch the game I want to watch. So now, it was only $70. I'm thinking, this is ridiculous. You're over 50 years old. You've worked hard your life. You can't spend $70 on something so you can... At some point, you got to remind yourself you can actually spend the money. Okay? I literally had a fight in my head to spend that money. So I could watch the game when it was convenient for me. Okay? Now, I never would have justified that money when I was broke. I wouldn't even have been a thought. But then it's hard to make the switch. And then when you're not broke and think, is it okay for me to buy this thing? $70. That's crazy. Why would I just record the show and whatever the game, if then it's not on TV. Who cares? It's a game. But then I said, wait a minute. But I've earned this. I worked hard so I can do some foolish, silly things to enjoy my life. Okay, like having internet on the boat. Okay, or whatever that is. And then you don't fuss and fret over it because it doesn't adversely affect your finances. What you don't do is do those things when it does affect your finances. Some of you just don't withhold anything from yourselves and you do whatever you want because you're going to spoil yourself and never say no to yourself when you don't have the money. Okay? That is very, very foolish. Okay? That is unwise. But if you have the finances to justify a Tesla or something nice, then go ahead and do it. Why not enjoy yourself? All of the heroes in the scriptures were wealthy. And they had all kinds of abundance. Now, they didn't have cars, but they had all kinds of abundance, okay? I'm sure if we got to see the tent that Abraham lived in, it was a nice tent, okay? All right? When they set up camp somewhere, it was a mansion tent. Because he was wealthy, All right? And so, yes, enjoy what you've worked hard for if you have that.
Okay.
Did that help?
It did. I don't, but thank you.
You don't, but I just, thank you.
I'm not fine at Tesla. I just, that question, that argument you had, yeah. That's what I have, where it's like, no, I can just do this. I'll just watch movies on YouTube. I won't go to the movie theater. So, yeah. No. Okay, no, thanks.
Look, I've stopped having that fight because I realize I'm not getting any younger. Because part of the reason we work hard is to enjoy ourselves. You say, what do we use the phrase? I'm working for a living. But if all you're doing is working and you don't have the living part, what was the point? Yeah. Okay?
Yeah. Amen.
And so I do enjoy things that I would never have enjoyed when I was not as, you know, financially stable. Because, you know, I realize that I'm not getting any younger and I should be able to enjoy things. You know, but I try to be wise with it. So some of you are thinking, well, Rabbi, you just went on a cruise and you went on one 2 months ago. Yeah, but do you know how much I paid? Do you know how cheap this cruise was? Do you understand? There is wisdom in it if you put it together. I mean, I can't imagine going anywhere for 5 days and the whole thing cost me $300, including entertainment and food and lodging. It's pretty cheap. Okay? I couldn't have had 3 meals out for 5 days for less than that. Just the meals. No shows, no lodging. The lodging would have been more than that for 5 days, right? It's $100 a day at least in most hotels. Okay? Or more. All right? So, you can't beat that kind of thing. And you can ask the elder. I did work on the boat a lot. So it wasn't so much of a vacation, but it was away from all of the day-to-day pulls. And so it was a refresher for me. But it's those things that you then choose to do because you can and you should. Because it gives you the motivation to keep doing what you're doing because it's paying off. There's a payoff, which means you get to enjoy the labors that you've done, the fruit of the labors. And so, yes, but just be conservative about it. In other words, try to get the best deals you can and only spend, you know, be wise with it. All right? Okay?
And then lastly, do you mind kind of tapping into when you were talking about challenges with Tamara's question on the fiery arrows that we quench of Satan from Ephesians 6:16?
Okay. You'll have to wait till part. We're not there yet. That's the next part. Well, but I have to finish the good news. You know what the good news is? I'm going to get to it next. That's the good news. See, because right after the preparation of the good news of peace is above all taking up the shield of belief which you have to power to quench the burning arrows. Okay? So we're going to get to that. Work on the patience part. All right, Ashley, you get to be last because it's 5:30.
Oh, goodness.
Somebody should go up and get the children.
I want to carefully and respectfully ask this question. A lot of people, one of the big passions of mine is food preservation, without getting into all the, pardon pun, all the meat of it. Lately, I've been having a lot of people say I'm anointed and appointed in that area, especially for what my plan is to do with it with this congregation. When someone says that, how do you know it's true? And two, how do you take that with such carefulness when you do give advice and things like that to not, because I want to do it very carefully and very respectfully. And
all right.
Yeah.
Look, don't worry about titling. Okay. If somebody tells you you're gifted or you're talented or you're anointed, don't worry about all that. What you want to do is be diligent to be careful, like you are, with giving counsel about anything, whether it's health or food or something emotional or relational or financial, any kind of guidance that you're going to give. Be really, really careful because you don't want to give somebody advice and it goes badly, right? But don't get or allow the titling to go to your head. Someone says, oh, you're anointed and appointed in this. Well, I don't even know that there is such a thing as anointed and appointed in those kind of things. Okay? I see very rarely the anointing and appointing, like, for example, when they were building the tabernacle, there was a special anointing given to the guys who were doing the creating of all of the materials for the building of the tabernacle. But you don't generally see people refer to that way in any other spot than in the ministry. But the thing is, you may have a gift and talent in an area and have a certain ability to convey that. So take that with all honor and respect and carefulness to give honor and respect to that potential gift, that you don't want to just go out there and get kind of full of yourself and just throw that around all over the place, and then you're giving people bad advice.
Is it okay then to say thank you, but like try to like downplay it and just
no, don't downplay it. Just say thank you. Just don't let it go to your head. Okay? If someone gives you a compliment like that, just take the compliment and say thank you, but just don't let it go to your head. Okay? Look, we talk about anointed, appointed all the time. I know a lot of you believe that I'm an anointed and appointed. I would agree with you. That's the way I've always understood what he's doing with me. But it's about letting it go to your head or not. I don't wield it in any kind of way. I just accept the responsibility of it. Okay? So it's not something that you then get to wield and like, you need to listen to me because I'm anointed and appointed. Or I've got this gift about whatever Ashley's talking about. I say, well, you need to take my advice because I'm anointed. You start to think that way, you can get in real trouble. Okay? You definitely don't want to allow yourself to do that. Okay. Excellent. Zone one.